Hey, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, and it's October 27th. And I think that microphone is up a little bit loud. Yeah, that's probably a little bit better. Okay, so everything's in Blackboard so far as I know. Lectures are available to you. Everything's ready to go. If there's a problem with Blackboard, of course, always give me a heads up. Like sometimes the quizzes are programmed so that you can't see your results. I would like for you to see your results. And do we have any news from SI? Any SI today? No SI today, right? There is SI today? Okay, good. I didn't mean to scare you. I thought I heard no. Okay, well, we'll ask. I'm sure there's SI. When is SI? Right after lecture? Okay. Yeah, I'm sure there is. All right, so today's the 27th, a nice Monday. We should get into autonomic nervous system, but we got to finish up peripheral nervous system first, and I can't remember even starting peripheral nervous system, so maybe we're a little bit behind, but that's okay, because we'll catch up. When is your next exam, lecture exam? It is 1, 2, 3 weeks away. Okay, so it's 3 weeks away. Chapters 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17. It will be all of those chapters. We'll get them out of the way. And on the 10th of November, that's a holiday. Don't come to class on that day. So that's probably one of the reasons why the next test is still 3 weeks away. You have a third practicum, and that will be next week. Right? So today's the 27th, and then starting November 3rd, your third practicum. And who can tell me what's going to be on that third practicum? What labs? I heard 7, 8, and 10, and I like that. Yep, 7, 8, and 10 are the labs. So three labs on that practicum. Okay, any questions on the schedule? Yes. So chapter 19, heart, will not be on the next exam. Will be on the last one on December 10th. Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. Maybe, well, we can talk about putting it on the next exam, but probably not. Okay? Okay. All right. Any other questions on schedule? Pretty good. All right. Any questions on central nervous system? Since we covered that last time, some things you got to know. For instance, central sulcus. What's a sulcus? It's a depression on the surface of the brain. Remember, the brain is not flat and smooth. It's convoluted, filled with gyri and sulci. So sulcus you should know about, central sulcus in particular, because right in front of that, anterior to the central sulcus, is the precentral gyrus. And what is that responsible for? Everybody should know. Where do you have the motor in your car? In the front, right? So it's a primary somatomotor cortex. That means that's what starts voluntary motion in your body. And skeletal muscles are what we call your somatic body. They're superficial. All right. And what's the post-central gyrus for? Sensory, yeah. And the arrangement, that's the primary somatosensory cortex, well, sensation on the surface of your body, kind of related to your skeletal muscles. And it is... It maps out almost exactly like the motor cortex does, where you have ability to move your hand on the precentral gyrus, where you feel sensations on your hand is this exact same area except in the postcentral gyrus, right? All right. Well, let's get started with peripheral nervous system. And peripheral nervous system is a little bit funny because we can't describe it like the central nervous system. How would you define central nervous system? Brain and spinal cord, right? That's really easy. And that means that the peripheral nervous system is everything else. So, oh, that's nice. How about if I turn these lights off too? Okay, so peripheral nervous system is all nervous tissue outside the brain and spinal cord, outside the central nervous system. All right, so we're going to talk about, and we've talked about this a little bit already, but sensory receptors. So somatic are sensory receptors in muscles and in limbs, right? We have visceral receptors in body cavities, like viscera would be the stomach, appendix, heart, lungs, things like that. and we usually don't feel anything from these particular organs. So visceral pain or visceral sensation is kind of unfamiliar to us, and it takes on a little bit different impression. Like pain to your skeletal muscle and bones is very acute, very sharp kind of pain, but visceral pain is still as observable. It's still as unpleasant, but it's more of a dull pain, a dull aching pain. So there's kind of a big difference between visceral pain, for instance, and somatic pain. All right, and then the another way we can classify peripheral nervous system is not just by sensation, but then by motor. Somatic sort of means going to skeletal muscle and everything that's not in a body cavity. Visceral goes to smooth muscle and cardiac muscle and glands, and especially to things that are located deep inside body cavities. That would be visceral motor. Got peripheral sensory receptors, peripheral motor endings that we're going to take a look at. All right, so some nerves leave the central nervous system. And what are the two parts of the central nervous system once again? Brain and spinal cord. So some nerves leave the brain. When they leave the brain, we're going to call them cranial nerves. And if other nerves leave the spinal cord or enter the spinal cord, we're going to call those spinal nerves. So that's not really too hard to see why those terms are designated like that. Well, we got 12 pairs of cranial nerves. So 12 pairs leave the brain. And then we have 31 pairs that leave the spinal cord. Of course, you know your spinal cord over the vertebral column is a lot longer than your brain is. So I think it would be easy to expect that we have more spinal nerves. All right, as far as receptors are concerned, this is pretty much a figure that we've looked at already from the integumentary system. We have sometimes free nerve endings, and I can see a free nerve ending around this hair follicle. So when the hair follicle moves, you have the perception of something brushing up against your skin. There are also free nerve endings just in the dermis, and these other free nerve endings are important for temperature sensation. So you have cold nerves and you got hot nerves that are kind of separated from each other, and also nociceptors, right, here for pain as well. And so that's really important because when something is damaging your body, you would like to be able to be aware of that so that you can withdraw that part of your body from what's ever damaging it, right? So pain sensation is important, although unpleasant. But that's okay because you don't want to experience that because it's damaging some part of your body. So besides free nerve ending, then we have specialized receptor cells like a Pacinian corpuscle, Meissner's corpuscles. These are specialized structures on the end of nerves that aren't responsible for pain or temperature, but for vibration and pressure. Right? They require special receptor nerve ending cells to do that. Another way that we can classify receptors, either by their extroreceptors or interoceptors. Extroreceptors are sensing something that's in the environment outside of your body, and again, that could be touch, pressure, pain, temperature. And, of course, some other kinds of organs, like eyes, the retina, is sensing something that's outside your body, namely light, right? And hearing is important for, that's an extroreceptor because you're hearing pressure that's in the external environment. Right? Interoceptors measure things that are inside your body, various chemicals, and if they're measuring chemicals, we call that a chemoreceptor. So there are cells that can measure how much glucose is in your blood, in the pancreas. So that would be a chemoreceptor, and it would also be an interoceptor. And these would all be viscera inside deep body cavities that produce sensations, for instance, hunger, when blood glucose concentration goes down, can produce a sensation of thirst, when the saltiness of your blood increases, right? So you have receptors for all of those different kinds of things inside your body, and even the amount of acid. You have pH receptors and oxygen receptors that are inside your body. Those would all be examples of interoceptors. The last kind of receptor that we see right here, proprioceptors. Proprioceptors give you a sense of body position. because we have proprioceptors in all of our joints, all of our tendons, all of our muscles, and they send signals back to the central nervous system to give your central nervous system an idea of where your limbs are, how much weight is being held up by a particular muscle system. Because the brain can send information out to skeletal muscles to contract, but the brain needs to get feedback from those skeletal muscles just to make sure that they're operating properly so that a joint isn't twisting when it's only a hinge joint, for instance. So that's what we call proprioception. Touch pressure, yeah, sometimes we classify a receptor by what it receives. Nociceptors here can measure pain, or if there's any kind of damaging chemical on the surface of your body, that will give you a sensation of discomfort. Photoreceptors, where do you have photoreceptors? In your eye, right. Okay. So we can then classify receptors, either they're encapsulated, like that Pacinian corpuscle, Meissner's corpuscles that you looked at. They can be non-encapsulated, like a free nerve ending, hair follicle receptors. And then the proprioceptors, this is kind of a special class. We call them muscle spindles. Muscle spindles are in skeletal muscle, and they measure stretch. Golgi tendon organ is in, where do we find a Golgi tendon organ? In tendon. Yeah, so we find those in tendon. So a muscle spindle measures stretch, but tendons, of course, don't stretch. So we don't want a stretch receptor there. We want something that can measure the tension on a tendon. And that's a Golgi tendon organ. They're going to be used for different purposes. For instance, if all of a sudden you try to lift a weight that's really, really super heavy, that's going to rip muscles, maybe rip a tendon off of a bone, or maybe even break a bone, this Golgi tendon organ measures that tension and then sends a signal to the spinal cord, and then the spinal cord causes those muscles to relax so that they don't rip a tendon off of a bone. So those are the important things there, the muscle spindle and Golgi tendon. So this right here, probably I would like to put down, not stretch, but what? Tension. Tension. So stretch for muscles, tension for Golgi tendon. The innervation of effector organs, right, is going to be a little bit different, whether it is going to skeletal muscle or if it's going to visceral muscle and glands. Could anybody tell me what are some examples of visceral muscle? Where do we find visceral muscle? On the surface of your body or someplace else? Deep inside a body cavity, right? So not attached to your skeletal system. So how many different kinds of muscle are you aware of deep inside body cavities? Cardiac and smooth muscle, right? So those are both effector organs for this autonomic innervation, and then of course glands. So the effector organ for the somatic nervous system is going to be skeletal muscle. Effector organs for autonomic nervous system are going to be smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands. That was on that very first slide that we showed you a couple weeks ago, or over a week ago. All right, so let's think about skeletal muscle. And so there is a special structure. There is a chemical synapse between that somatic motor neuron and the skeletal muscle. And so since it's a chemical synapse, that means that there has to be a chemical signal that's released by the neuron that diffuses to the skeletal muscle that causes the muscle to contract. And that's called the neuromuscular junction. Does anybody know what that neurotransmitter is? That chemical that goes from the neuron to the skeletal muscle? It's got a special name. It is called acetylcholine. Acetylcholine is the neurotransmitter. When applied to a skeletal muscle, will cause it to contract. And what does that look like? All right, so here we see a nice cross-section of the spinal cord, and we can see some nerves. So here's the cell body of a nerve, and it leaves the ventral root, goes into the spinal nerve. Oh, we're going to have to talk about that today. It's an important part of the peripheral nervous system. And then that one cell, that one nerve fiber, goes all the way to a skeletal muscle. So here we see a bunch of skeletal muscles. We can call these things fibers as well. And notice that looks blue to me. This blue neuron goes to how many muscle cells? I see one here, and I see one here. So this particular neuron can excite both of these nerve cells or nerve fibers when an electrical impulse comes down. These little nerve endings release acetylcholine, and that causes these skeletal muscles to contract, at least these two. Right? What about this red neuron? How many muscle cells does this go to? You see, it's three. So there are what we call different motor units. So a motor unit is one nerve fiber and the individual muscle cells that it goes to. So motor unit number one and number two, which one will produce a stronger contraction, number one or number two? Number two, because it has more nerve cells that are being told to contract. All right, so the motor unit is a way that we can explain how we can pick up something that's very light, okay, like this little bottle of Coca-Cola right here, or I can pick up something really heavy like a bowling ball. Right, so just different numbers of motor units are going to be recruited as the object gets heavier and heavier and heavier. And probably you've been fooled. A lot of visual information goes into designating how many motor units are going to be used to lift an object up. Have you ever been tricked? Maybe you thought something was really heavy and you picked it up and it almost starts flying out of your hand because you had the impression that it was really light. Anybody give me an example of that? When does that ever happen to you? I can think of an example. Right? If I went into a restaurant, this has happened to me a couple times, and of course everybody asks for water, and if they serve it to you in a big heavy glass mug filled with water and ice, you're going to need a lot of these muscle fibers to lift it up to take a drink. Right? But a couple times I've lifted up this really heavy glass mug and it goes almost flying off the table into whoever I'm sitting next to, because what can you tell me about the really heavy glass mug? It's made out of plastic. It's a lot lighter, right? So I thought it was something really heavy and it almost goes flying out of my hand. That's because of those muscle spindles are sending information back to the spinal cord saying, hey, that muscle isn't behaving the way you thought it should be behaving. Right? And then some of these motor units then are shut down, and then I have much better control of that very light object. Right, so we call this recruitment. Right? Maybe you try to pick up something that's heavy, you didn't think it was very heavy, you can't lift it off the ground, then you have to concentrate a little bit more, and more motor units then are recruited to where maybe all of the muscle fibers within a muscle contract to lift something heavy. So that's what we mean by motor unit. These things right here, this is that neuromuscular junction. It always releases acetylcholine and it always causes this muscle to contract. Right, so that the skeletal muscle can never make up its mind whether it's going to contract or not. Unlike other types of muscle, right, like smooth muscle and glands, instead of having the ends of an axon release neurotransmitter, the neurons that go to cardiac muscle and smooth have areas all along the axon as it moves through the organ that can release neurotransmitter, adjusting whether a gland is going to secrete or if a smooth muscle is going to contract or maybe if that smooth muscle should relax. Those are what we call varicosities. It kind of just looks like a string of pearls along the axon. Nonetheless, each one of those little swellings releases a neurotransmitter onto cardiac muscle or smooth muscle. Sometimes it is acetylcholine, but other times it's something else. Does anybody know a name of another kind of neurotransmitter that can be used? Norepinephrine is a really good example. Norepinephrine and acetylcholine are probably two really good neurotransmitters that you should be aware of. Okay, so two different kinds of nerve endings depending on where they go, whether they go to skeletal muscle or if they go to the autonomic effectors like heart, smooth muscle, and glands. All right, well, let's talk about some nerves, cranial nerves. Where do cranial nerves exit the central nervous system? The brain, yeah. Cranial nerves leave the brain and As a matter of fact, where do we have a nice picture of some cranial nerves? Okay, this looks good right here. So this is an exam figure. And of course, you can see the brain. This is a nice ventral view of the brain, frontal lobe, temporal. Right here is the cerebellum. And who could tell me what this thing is here? This is the, that's the pons, and here is the medulla. So some of these cranial nerves leave the pons, some leave the medulla, and some actually leave more from the cerebrum. All right, so there are 12 pair. And it's actually pretty easy to know the numbers of these things because they're numbered number 1 through number 12 as you go from anterior to posterior, right? And you're going to count 12 of them. So here's cranial nerve number 1, here's cranial nerve number 2, here's number 3, here's number 4, right? Here's number 5. So that's pretty easy. All right, but I do want you to know the functions of some of these cranial nerves, right? And also their name. And some of these cranial nerves are pretty complex. So here is just a little cheat sheet that I want you to know for each of these cranial nerves. You don't have to memorize everything. Just one item is fantastic. All right, so here is the olfactory bulb. And we haven't talked about the sense of olfaction just yet, but can anybody tell me what it is? What's the sense of olfaction, the olfactory sense? Yeah, it's smell. Smell and olfaction is the same thing, right? And cranial nerve number 1 is responsible for that. And I guess that's pretty easy to think about because what's the most anterior sense organ on your face? Like if you walk into a window because you don't see it, what's going to get smashed first? It's your nose, right? Okay. That's cranial nerve number 1. There's a little bit of a swelling on the end, and that's where the olfactory nerves leave the central nervous system and actually go down into your nasal cavity to perceive various odorant molecules. So cranial nerve 1 is olfaction. All right, and as you walk into that glass window, what is the next sense organ that you're going to smash? Eye, and then you're going to end up with a black eye. All right, so the next one here, number 2, is going to be the optic nerve. So number 1, olfactory, number 2, optic. And as a matter of fact, you can see that this is the nerve that's going to go to an eyeball someplace out over here. That's going to bring information into the central nervous system. And then some of the nerves are going to cross over each other. Right where they cross over each other, then that is the separation, the line that separates the peripheral and central nervous system. We call that the optic chiasma. Right? And you have an optic chiasma because things that you see over in your right visual field from both eyes end up on the left side of your brain. And things that you see in the left, whether it's the right or left eye, if you see something on the left, it goes over to the right side of your brain. It crosses over. And where does it cross over? Where do some of those fibers cross over? Where do they cross over? Yeah, you're pointing right to it. It is the optic chiasma. That's where some of those nerve fibers cross over. And remember that the entrance to the nervous system, and so what do we call myelinated axons in the central nervous system? Yeah, it's white matter for sure, but we have white matter in the peripheral nervous system. So I want you to make sure you know what white matter in the peripheral nervous system is and what white matter in the central nervous system is called. What about central nervous system? I think we talked about that fast. That is a tract. White matter in central nervous system is a tract. White matter in peripheral nervous system is a nerve. So here is the optic nerve, crosses over at the chiasma, then it's becomes part of the central nervous system. So this segment right here is the optic tract. So you got optic nerve, chiasma, optic tract. All right, number 3, oculomotor. And as the name says, that's it. That's an important motor fiber that innervates extrinsic eye muscles that moves your eye right and left, up and down, for instance, without having to turn your head. All right, number 4, trochlear nerve. The number 5, trigeminal. See, trigeminal is pretty big nerve. I would like to be able to show you that in lab, but when we do our dissection of the brain, it's really hard to remove the meninges and keep that trigeminal nerve. A lot of times we can actually save the oculomotor nerve. We can see the optic chiasma and olfactory and then oculomotor, and then the rest pretty much get destroyed when we do our dissection. All right, so that's 5. Number 6, again, this is a motor nerve, abducens. It goes to a skeletal muscle on the eye, And guess what it does to the eyeball? Abducens. You've run into this term already. Does it flex? Does it extend? It what? It abducts the eye, right? So it makes one eyeball look laterally to the side. And of course the other one, the abducens, isn't used at the same time unless you can do that. But you probably shouldn't have both your eyeballs look laterally at the same time. Because what did your mother tell you? They might get stuck, right? Well, that's not true, but anyway, abducens makes a lateral rotation or abduction of the eye, so you can look to the side. Okay, so that is six. All right, so where is seven located? Well, it's in this bundle right here, facial nerves. All right, so these are nerves. Some of them are motor, some are sensory, that they go to the face. Here is number eight, vestibulocochlear nerve. That goes to your ear, and so that's important for hearing, vestibulocochlear nerve, and also for balance. It helps give you equilibrium balance. We're going to talk about those two different senses that are in your ear. All right, glossopharyngeal. Anytime you hear this glossal term, you should think of tongue. All right, so here's a nerve that goes to the tongue. All right, and then 10 is right over here. 10 is an important nerve. It's vagus nerve. I want you to learn a lot about the vagus nerve because it's part of the autonomic nervous system, in particular the parasympathetic nervous system. And that's the topic of the whole next chapter. So you can't really appreciate too much of it, except when you hear that term, cranial nerve number 10, what name are you going to assign to cranial nerve number 10? Vagus nerve, right? And vagus nerve is an important nerve in your autonomic nervous system. Autonomic nervous system. We're going to talk about that in the next chapter. All right, so then we got 11. And how many pairs of nerves do we have? You got 12, right? So, and then here is the 12th nerve. This one right here, number 11, is kind of strange because it leaves the cranium, right, and then it comes back up through the foramen magnum. It kind of loops around, and that's really strange when you first see that. All right, so how are you going to remember the names of these cranial nerves? Well, the number is easy, right, just from anterior to posterior, but how are you going to remember the names, like olfactory, optic, oculomotor, trochlear, trigeminal? Well, one thing in anatomy that you can do, and chemistry, and all these different disciplines, if you have a list of words that you want to make sure that you get the list in the correct order, you can make up a mnemonic. And a mnemonic is just a little saying that is easy to remember, and the first letter in the list of words that you want to memorize becomes the first letter of a mnemonic. So when you say the mnemonic, you know what the first letter of that word is that you're trying to remember. So here is a mnemonic for the names of cranial nerves. And it is, on Olympus's towering top, a fin and German viewed a hop. Okay, now maybe that doesn't make sense to you, but it should make sense to you because otherwise you won't remember it. So who could explain this mnemonic? What does this mean, on Olympus's? I guess if you're a European, you really know, because Olympus is a big, huge mountain in Europe, right? And so that's where this towering top comes from. So it means the mountain top. And Olympus is what? A really old mountain, right? And what's a Finn? A Finn is somebody from Finland, right? And what about a German? A German is somebody from Germany. So these two people are sitting on top of Olympus, right? And they're looking down into a valley, and what are they seeing down in the valley? They're seeing fields of grain, and both Germans and Finns, I guess, like to drink a lot of beer, and this particular grain is used to make what? Beer, hops. All right, so that's an understanding of this particular mnemonic right here. So we can look at these. So on, the first letter corresponds to what? O in olfactory. Old, the O in optic, Olympus from oculomotor, and then what we got? Trochlear, trigeminal, abducens, right? Facial, right? And then we've got vestibular cochlear for A, And then G for what? Glossopharyngeal. V for? Vagus. Yeah, really important nerve. That's number 10, right? And there's only two left. Accessory and hypoglossal. Okay, so does anybody have any questions on that? No? You're talking amongst yourselves. What are you concerned with? You concerned with any of these right here? Probably, but you're a little shy. Let's look at this one right here. Thin and German. What about this and? It's an A. What does that correspond to? Vestibulocochlear. Well, I lied to you. This is an A. Vestibulocochlear starts with a V, right? Do you see that inconsistency? And that's because the vestibulocochlear nerve used to be called the auditory nerve. Auditory. Right? And now it's been simplified. It's been converted from auditory to vestibulocochlear nerve. It makes it a little bit easier to remember. And when we get to special senses, you'll really appreciate that because cochlear is for hearing. That's the auditory part. That vestibular part is for that equilibrium sensation. And you're going to see that nerve in lab, actually, this week. All right, so you can come up with any mnemonic that you like. Right? And how many words should your mnemonic have? Should have 12, right, because there's 12 pairs of nerves. A mnemonic that you make up yourself probably is better because when you start to experience stress on a test, you have an easier time remembering your own mnemonic rather than on Olympus's towering top of Finn in German, view to hop. Maybe you can't even memorize that because maybe you don't even like beer. Okay. Okay. There is a website that you can go to look up mnemonics, chemistry mnemonics, biology mnemonics, anatomy mnemonics, and it's called medicalmnemonics.com. Medical mnemonics is just all one word. Here's how you spell mnemonics. And then you can set a filter because you can get a PG mnemonic. You can get, a PG-13. You can get X-rated mnemonics, all that kind of stuff. But I don't want you to use any X-rated mnemonics in here, please. Okay? No X-rated mnemonics from medicalmnemonics.com. Okay. All right. So some of these cranial nerves, some, like for instance, optic, okay, what do you think optic is? Well, it's for vision, right? Is that sensory or motor? Sensory. Some of these cranial nerves are sensory. Oculomotor, you think that's sensory or motor? That's motor, that's right. So some cranial nerves are purely motor. Some are purely sensory, some are purely motor. And then some have components of both. Some are used for sensation and some are used for motor purposes as well. And so that's what we call mixed. A nerve that has both sensory and motor function, it is mixed. And so here is another mnemonic that tells you which of these nerves are sensory, which ones are motor, and which ones are mixed. And here it is. All right. The S stands for sensory, M stands for motor. Oh, but mixed was M2, so that would be confusing with motor. So we come up with another name, both. Both is what? Mixed, and that starts with a B. And here's a mnemonic. A lot of people say this all the time. The mnemonic is, some say money matters, but my brother says big brains matter most. So this tells you, how many words are here? There are 12. Okay, and this S stands for sensory, and that's cranial nerve number 1. And what is that? That is for smell. Cranial nerve number 2, S, that is vision. All right? And then number 3, money, what is that? That's motor. Right? Oculomotor, one example would be pupil constriction. All right? So this tells you the physiology of each of these cranial nerves right here. So that is handy to know that. All right, so that's all with this nice exam figure. You got to know which ones are motor, which ones are sensory, which ones are mixed. And then, of course, their number, their name, and what their function is by this list right here. If you know some other function of that nerve, that's fine. Right? But these are probably the ones that I would use on a lecture exam. And in particular, let's look at this vagus. What number is vagus once again? 10. And what is in your list for what the function of the vagus nerve is? Decreases heart rate. All right, so is control of your heart rate, do you think that's a really important function or maybe not so important? That's hugely important, right? And so here is one nerve that can slow the heart down, and there's another nerve that's going to speed the heart up. So the vagus just is really important. It's an antagonistic muscle that helps you maintain precise control and balance of your heart rate because it is so important. All right, so those are cranial nerves. Let's look at some spinal nerves. Now, what's the function of a spinal nerve? It says right here. Function of a spinal nerve is, I just covered it up on you, unfortunately. I'll put it away. What's the function? Is it sensory, the spinal nerve, or is it motor? It is mixed. It's both. All right, so let's take a look at some of these. You know what? Before we get there, here's a really good example of a muscle spindle, right, for measuring tension within a muscle. It has these different components to it. So if a muscle starts to stretch uncontrollably, this thing here will contract the muscle to prevent that muscle from stretching any further. And probably you all have done this. Have you ever sat in a chair and then somebody with a little rubber mallet hit your patellar tendon, hit you on the knee? Remember where your patellar tendon is, right? And then after they hit you on the knee like that, what happens? Your quadriceps contract, because when they tap you on the patellar tendon, it stretches the quadriceps, and this muscle spindle right here says, hey, wait a second, your muscle is stretching, something bad might happen to you, like you might fall down, for instance. This muscle spindle doesn't know that somebody tapped you with a hammer on purpose, right? So that causes this muscle to contract, right, to prevent that muscle from stretching any further, right? So we call that a patellar tendon reflex. Okay. Spinal nerve organization. So we're familiar with this because I see spinal cord. What is this thing coming out of the spinal cord? Okay. I think we talked about this last time. This is a root, right? And then what do we have over here? Another root, right? So there are two roots. So here is the dorsal root, here is the ventral root, and what's the function of a root? A function of a root. Is it ever mixed? And you should think no, and I see some people shaking their heads, no, that's fantastic, okay? The dorsal root is 100% sensory. This is how information gets into the central nervous system. And the ventral root is 100% motor, right? And that's how information leaves. And as a matter of fact, we can see it with this diagram. Here I see a neuron bringing information into the spinal cord. And does anybody recognize the shape of this particular neuron? Is it multipolar? Is it bipolar? Or unipolar? It's unipolar, right? I just see one little process coming out that bifurcates. So here is a unipolar neuron, and we said the function of a unipolar neuron is always sensory. Yeah, it's sensory. And you can see here is the peripheral process of that unipolar neuron going out to the periphery. And then what did we call this process of a unipolar? If this is peripheral, this is the central process, right? It's all one cell. And then here is a synapse between the sensory neuron and this one. That is completely within the central nervous system. And I think we identified this one once before. Can anybody name this neuron or this one here? It has two different names. You could call it an interneuron, or you could call it an association neuron, because it's going to take information from one neuron to another. And it's located between those two. It's an interneuron. But it also can carry information between these neurons, and so we call that an association neuron. Okay, so here is the dorsal root ganglia. Remember, a ganglia is a bunch of nerve cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system, and that is always going to be on the dorsal root, right? Because that's sensory, and these unipolar neurons are sensory. All right, that will send signals into this association neuron, for instance. And then there's a neuron that goes from, of course, this is gray matter in the spinal cord. So here is the cell body. And that one neuron goes all the way to an effector organ. Right? And in this particular case, this is a nice skeletal muscle. So this is what we call a somatic motor neuron, because this is a little motor, right? Skeletal muscle is a motor of your somatic, just on the surface of the body. So how many neurons does it take to go from the central nervous system to skeletal muscle? How many synapses do you see from central nervous system? Here's the cell body, here's the axon, and where does it go? All the way to skeletal muscle. So it only requires one neuron to go all the way from central nervous system to skeletal muscle. If it is a somatic outflow pathway, if it goes to a voluntary skeletal muscle. Okay, and it, of course, leaves the ventral root. We see that the ventral roots join together right here. This is what we call the spinal nerve. And what is the function of a spinal nerve? You could tell me. How many colors do you see here? How many colors do you see? Two, right? I see a sensory color and a motor color. That means that the function of a nerve is always going to be mixed. What about a root? Either sensory 100% or motor 100%. All right, so what part of the spinal cord is this right here? Ventral or anterior? Here is dorsal or posterior. You kind of know where your vertebral column is. Where is most of your body located? Is it in front of your vertebral column or behind? And most of it is in front, right? So after the spinal nerve forms, it splits into two nerves, and that's what we call a ramus. The dorsal ramus innervates everything that is posterior to the vertebral column, and that's going to be a relatively thin nerve because you don't have much body back there. And then here is the ventral ramus that innervates everything in front of the vertebral column. And since you have most of your body that way, then this is a really big nerve, right? So the dorsal ramus is kind of thin, the ventral ramus is going to be very big and thick. And indeed, does this motor neuron, since it goes to, it looks like the biceps right here, should that come down through the ventral ramus? And your answer is yes, because that muscle is in front of or anterior to the vertebral column. It can't take the dorsal ramus to get to this particular skeletal muscle. Okay, so talked about roots, rami, spinal nerves, and in the next chapter we're going to talk about this rami communicantes. Maybe I have a picture of it. Maybe not. Maybe right here. Oh, I do. All right, so here is that spinal cord. These are rootlets that join together to form a root. Right, here's the dorsal root. Here's the ventral root. When they come together, that forms a spinal nerve. And then here is the dorsal ramus, which is kind of small. Here is the ventral ramus, which is really large. But I see a couple other pathways coming off the spinal nerve. I see one here and here. And they're going to something that looks like almost like a string of pearls that are on either side of the vertebral column. And these are what we call the sympathetic chain ganglia. So here is a bunch of what, nerve cell bodies and dendrites, because it's a swelling outside the central nervous system. And this is a very important part of the autonomic nervous system, and in particular the sympathetic nervous system. So we call these the sympathetic chain ganglia. Information can move from the spinal nerve through these things that we call the rami communicantes. We're going to actually work with these in a little bit more detail in the next chapter. So sympathetic nerve signals flow through these communicantes into the sympathetic chain or out of the sympathetic chain. And once that nerve signal is in the sympathetic chain, where can it go? It can go up, or it can go down, or it can actually go out, okay, via this communicantes here to some part of your body. So the sympathetic chain ganglia, you should almost think of them as, for instance, like being spinal cords, accessory spinal cords for the sympathetic nervous system, because it can share information all over the place. All right, let's look at some of these structures right here. Here is, right, your spinal cord. And remember, spinal cord stops right here at about the level of L2. I see a little conus medullaris. Oh, I can even see a phylum terminale, right? And what is this structure on either side of the phylum terminale? This is called the cauda equina. These are all nerves. Your spinal cord is not as long as your vertebral column is, right? But I see a complex of nerves here. I see another one, right? I see another one, and I see another mix of nerves right over here. These are what we call plexes, nerve plexes. We have a number of them in your body. I want you to become aware of three of them. In the neck, we're going to call this the cervical plexus. Right? The ones that go to your arm, we're going to call this the brachial plexus. Right? And then down over in this region, we're going to call this the lumbar plexus. Right? And then down over here, the sacral plexus, right? So we got three of these. So let's zoom into some of these different plexes. I'm not going to ask you to know a whole lot about them, but here's a plexus. All right, so C1, the spinal nerve comes out between C1. What's another name for C1? Atlas and the occipital bone. All right, that's where C1 comes from. And C2 comes from between C1 and C2. And so because the first one comes off above C1, there's actually going to be 8 of these spinal nerves in that cervical region. So they come out and they bifurcate, join together. And so, I don't know, why do we have this plexus right here? It just seems so complicated. Why do we have this plexus? Well, here's a nerve. Right, supraclavicular nerve, right over here. Where can it get signals from? From C4 and C3, maybe even C2, maybe even a little bit of C1. So that just means that if there is damage to any of these nerves, right, important organs that receive information from the supraclavicular nerve can get information from each of these areas. So important information can take alternate routes to get to an important effector organ in your body. And I think you're familiar with that because, I don't know, does anybody have to hop on a freeway to get to school? Yeah. And so sometimes you turn on the radio and you listen for traffic news, right? And if your freeway is all backed up, maybe there's a signal alert, what are you going to do? Is there more than one way to get to school? Yeah, you can take an alternate route. Right, so that's the beauty of this plexus. It can sustain a lot of damage without losing control of organs that are distal to the plexus. That's why it's there. Okay, here is another one, phrenic nerve. Now this one I do want you to know something about. Where does phrenic nerve get information from? C4 and C3. And the phrenic nerve is an important nerve. It innervates the diaphragm. Look at your muscle list from lab, and what does a diaphragm allow you to do? Inspiration allows you to breathe. Is breathing good? Yeah, can't live without breathing, right? All right, so this nerve has to be functional in order for that diaphragm to contract, in order for you to breathe in. And so it has, so nerve signals can come from each of these different origins. So if somebody hurts their neck and maybe even breaks their spinal cord, if they have a break between C3 and C4, can they still breathe? Yes, because there are elements of C3 that make up the phrenic nerve, right? So they're actually pretty lucky. They can still breathe. But if they have an injury that is above C3, then they can't breathe. Then what do they need? Then they need somebody that knows CPR that can breathe for them, right, until they can be put on a respirator. All right, so I do want you to know the origin of the phrenic nerve, and there's a little saying, it's not a mnemonic, but there's a little, like a little poem that you can recite to remember what the origin of the phrenic nerve is, and maybe you have one that you use, but the one that I use is C3, 4, and 5 keeps you alive. C3, 4, and 5 keeps you alive because these make up the phrenic nerve, and what does that allow you to do? Allows you to breathe in, right? So that's a hugely important nerve. All right, so this is from the cervical plexus. Brachial plexus, I want you to know where it is, but you don't have to tell me what nerves that it makes up. You could probably guess, right? Ulnar nerve, radial nerve, come out of the brachial plexus. Lumbar plexus, there's an important nerve that I do want you to know something about. Okay. Let me find lumbar plexus. Okay, so I see lumbar plexus and I see sacral plexus. That's sacral plexus. Where the heck is the lumbar plexus at? Okay, lumbar plexus. Maybe some of you have heard of a sciatic nerve. So what is the origin of the sciatic nerve? Well, where is it? Here's femoral nerve. Okay. Where's my little arrow? Okay. Here is the sacral plexus. So what is the origin of the sciatic nerve? It is both lumbar, so L4, 5, but also origins from S1 and S2 make up the sciatic nerve. Right? And that sciatic nerve goes right through the greater sciatic notch, pretty close. So if somebody exercises those muscles in that area, it could displace this nerve or pinch it up against the os coxae, and that could produce pain. Or it could produce motor deficits in whatever part of the body the sciatic nerve goes to. All right, so sciatic is part from the lumbar and part from the sacral plexus. So I want you to know what the function is of a plexus, and I want you to be at least aware of what some of the problems that can arise. Okay, so you can see nerves come out and they mix together, right? They split apart, they mix together again, they split apart and they can mix together again, right? And so this is how we classify a plexus. Right, so a ramus, right, comes from a spinal nerve, and I think I just want you to call that a ramus. And so different rami can join together, right, can mix together, and that forms a trunk. So for the so here I see upper, middle, and lower trunks, and then these things split apart into anterior and posterior parts. That's what we call a division. Different divisions can come together to form a cord, right? And then these cords can come together to form different nerves in different parts of our body. So you got root, trunk, division, cord, which then leads to a nerve through a plexus. So all plexes have all of these divisions. And I just want you to be able to tell me that if you hear something about a cord, where is a cord located? It's located in a nerve plexus. Where's a trunk located? In a nerve plexus. It's something that makes up a nerve plexus. And if you ever move on to like a whole year anatomy class, then of course you're going to have to remember all of the names of these different trunks, right? And where's a really good example? Okay, all of these things have names, right? But what you see on your lecture sheet right here are just the ones that I want you to know. I want you to know these four plexes and what nerves come from two of them. That's important for this class. All right, a dermatome. All right, well, we looked at the sacral, the sciatic nerve, and where does that sciatic nerve go to? Okay, so here is a nice map of a human, and you can see that there are different designations, different areas, and they're labeled with what nerve innervates that particular region. All right, so L1 innervates this region here, L3 down here in the thigh, and then L5, a little piece of the thigh, but mostly the leg. Right, is L5. What about C7? Where does C7 go? Yeah, all the way to your hand and fingertips, okay, is C7. And so here we have L5 going to your toes, L4 to your great toe down over here. And remember, we were talking about body motion at one period of time, like flexion and extension. And we finally started talking about motion at the ankle. What are the motions at the ankle? Dorsiflexion, lift your toes up off the ground. Plantar flexion, push your toes into the ground. And I said this really important to observe in people, maybe your grandparents, or if you ever become a healthcare provider, and you look at the tips of their shoes. If the tips of their shoes are wearing down, that means a patient can't do what? They can't dorsiflex, right? And I said at that time, that's a really nice indication of spinal cord injury or nerve leaving the spinal cord at that time, right? And we said it was important because a person could trip and then break a bone. So where would you want to start looking for somebody that can't dorsiflex? L4 and L5, okay, by looking at this dermatome right here. So you'd want to look to see where L4 and L5 come from. Okay, and investigate to see if there is maybe an intervertebral disc that has herniated or some kind of compression of those nerves that are leaving that particular area. So that's why this diagram is pretty nice to have. All right, so that is peripheral nervous system. Let me see if there's anything else that I want to say about peripheral nervous system. I think that's pretty good. Or peripheral nervous system. Cranial nerves, spinal nerves. Make sure you know the difference between a root and a ramus. Oh, they do want to show you this. Okay, so here is, what kind of view is this? What kind of section is this? Is this sagittal, coronal, transverse? Yeah, this is a nice cross section or transverse section. Here I can see a vertebral body, and here are some transverse processes, spinous process. So right here is that intervertebral foramen. This is where things can enter or leave the vertebral column. And indeed, what do I see? I see dorsal root ganglia. Here's the dorsal root. What's the function of this dorsal root? This is sensory, 100% sensory, goes into the spinal cord. Here's the ventral root, which is 100% motor, right? And they come together to form the spinal nerve, right? And then there's a bifurcation. Bifurcation just means a splitting of that spinal nerve. Here you can see a ramus. Here you can see another ramus. What was this first one that I pointed to? This is the, it's going to all the muscles that are posterior to the vertebral column. So this is the dorsal ramus. Here is the ventral ramus, and where does it go? Innervates everything that is anterior to the vertebral column. All these muscles, for instance, and this is going to be in the thoracic region. So this nerve right here is actually going to go through that costal groove in a rib, because a rib is going to protect that nerve. Remember where that costal groove is in a rib. Right, and then here's sympathetic chain ganglia, but what this diagram shows you very nicely are the roots, the dorsal root ganglia, spinal nerve, and the ventral and dorsal ramus, and where they go in the body. Right, and of course from this you should be able to tell me what the function of a ramus is. It is, function is, okay, what's the function of this dorsal root? It's sensory. What's the function of this ventral? Motor, right? And so what's the function of a spinal nerve? It's mixed, and the ramus is mixed as well. Okay, so the function of a ramus is mixed, but a root is going to either be sensory or motor, but never mixed, never both. Okay, so I did want to make sure you saw that. All right, so that's for peripheral nervous system. Anybody have questions about peripheral nervous system? Probably not. They just know those plexis, know what the origin is of the sciatic nerve, phrenic nerve, and of course the importance of the phrenic nerve. So that takes us to the autonomic nervous system. Put this over here. So what we've been looking at so far mostly has been the somatic nervous system. And let's just see if we can recall, where does the somatic nervous system go to? Somatic motor. Where does somatic motor? It goes to skeletal muscle, right? So it brings voluntary information to skeletal muscle so you can move your skeleton around. And can you remember, how many nerves does it take to get from the spinal cord all the way to a skeletal muscle? I closed that picture down already, but does anybody remember? It was one. Yeah, it was just one. It's just one. Maybe I got to go back and find it. Peripheral nervous system, where is that? Right here. All right, so here is the nerve cell body in the gray matter. And of course, this is a motor neuron because you see it leaving the ventral root. And where does it go? All the way to the skeletal muscle. So we call that a somatic motor neuron. And is that a unipolar neuron? What does it look like? It doesn't look like a unipolar because that's up over here. What about bipolar? No. That only leaves one left. So somatic motor neuron is what type? It is a multipolar neuron, right, with dendrites and cell body up over here and one long axon going to a skeletal muscle. All right, so that's part of the somatic outflow pathway. And now what we want to look at is something from the autonomic nervous system. All right, autonomic nervous system controls everything but skeletal muscle in your body. So the effector organs, remember that very first picture we looked at, the effector organs for autonomic nervous system is cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, and glands, right? If you get hot and start sweating, you can't stop sweating just by thinking about it, right? All right, that's under autonomic control, and you can think of autonomic as being like automatic. It's something you don't have to think about. So what are some other things that you can't think about, you can't control? And it's a really good thing because we wouldn't have enough time to think about it. But we can't control blood pressure voluntarily, heart rate, digestive processes we can't control, urination, sweating, pupil dilation or constriction, and all kinds of other things. As long as it has to do with smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands, it's under autonomic control. And when we looked at, when we broke down the nervous system into autonomic nervous system, how many main divisions were there? How many divisions were there of the autonomic nervous system? And maybe I can see it on this slide right here. All right, what do we have? Autonomic, here's somatic, which goes to what? Skeletal muscle, here's autonomic. How many different nervous systems are under autonomic? One, two. What are the divisions? Sympathetic and parasympathetic, okay? And I think you should probably take a guess at what's the relationship between these two nervous systems right here. If you're going to design a nervous system, okay, to control, for instance, heart rate, to have precise control and balance, what do you need with these two nervous systems? They should be antagonistic to each other. Right, just like a gas pedal and a brake pedal in your car. All right, so you should always think of sympathetic and parasympathetic as being antagonistic to each other. You can't always tell which one is excitatory, which one is inhibitory, because sometimes they switch. The only thing you know for sure is that if the sympathetic nervous system is excitatory, you know the parasympathetic system is inhibitory. Right, you only know that they're going to be opposite each other. Okay, so all autonomic outflow from the body, right, goes through these two different nervous systems. So let's take a look at what that is. Where is this at? Ah, here. Because I have to close that down. Why is that not showing? Ah, okay. All right, so here is a slide. It's a little bit busy, but we're going to take a look at this. And we're going to start with the somatic nervous system because we're familiar with that already. Somatic nerves go to skeletal muscle. We call that the effector organ for the somatic nervous system. And how many nerves does it take to get from central nervous system all the way to this effector organ? One. And do you see one neuron right here? Indeed you do. Right? Indeed you do, you do, you do. And what can you tell me about this axon? Yeah. Top secret.
Yeah, the one at the left in the net is for $10 more as part of our package.
Dang, I haven't looked at it. Give me a quick synopsis. I think I looked at it, but I can't remember.
Where they have the online quizzes and
stuff
like that. The whole PAL CD is integrated there.
Yeah.
You could assign different things like practice quizzes or homework and all that stuff.
Yeah. I kind of do that already.
Yeah.
So
you do that.
Yeah.
Master in AMP though?
But with questions that are open source in Pearson already.
Yeah. This
I would do it. I'm not super enthusiastic about it, but I'm okay.
Try it out?
Yeah.
Okay. It's only $10 more.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and then everybody gets a code in their textbook.
Right.
And then log in, and if it works out.
I think they compare it with your section.
Okay.
In Blackboard, if you have a Blackboard section.
Okay. I'll let them know, and then if it works, it works. If it doesn't, we'll just kick it out.
Yeah.
All right. Cool.
I like it. Take. You didn't hear me, did you? It's supposed to be top secret. Okay. Well, somebody should tell me, what were we talking about? The somatic motor system, right? Somatic motor, where does somatic motor go? Skeletal muscle. What kind of control is that? Autonomic or voluntary? It's voluntary. How many nerves does it take to get from central nervous system to that effector organ? Yeah, just one, right? And you see a nice myelinated axon, so that means what? Fast nerve impulses move down this axon. And it's a nice chemical synapse. The neurotransmitter at the neuromuscular junction is, you see it right here, acetylcholine. And when acetylcholine is released on the skeletal muscle, it always contracts. It can't make up its mind to do anything else, right? So in this particular case, nerve impulses on the somatic motor neuron are always excitatory. Right? They're always excited. Stimulatory, I don't know if I like. I like excitatory and inhibitory. But in this case, that muscle is going to contract. All right. This other rectangle down over here represents the autonomic nervous system, right? This first row is the somatic, which is voluntary. Autonomic is, but not under voluntary control. And that can be broken down into sympathetic and parasympathetic. And let's look at this top row. How many neurons does it take to get from central nervous system to an effector organ? I see one and I see two. See a cell body? What kind of synapse is this? Is this an electrical or chemical synapse? Chemical, and the chemical is called a neurotransmitter because it comes from a neuron. And the name of this neurotransmitter is acetylcholine. Right. Okay. Well, that's going to excite this other neuron, the second neuron. And nerve impulses are going to come down over here. Now, when this gets to an effector organ, there's another chemical synapse. This second neuron is going to release neurotransmitter, but is it acetylcholine? No. It's going to be NE. NE stands for, it says right here, norepinephrine. Okay, so for sympathetic nervous system, sympathetic, which means autonomic, the neurotransmitter at the effector organ is norepinephrine. For somatic outflow, it is acetylcholine, right? So you should be able to compare and contrast these. Somatic, one neuron, autonomic outflow, two neurons. Now this right here is in what nervous system, central or peripheral nervous system? Right here. Let's take a look at the top of the illustration. This area over here is what? Central nervous system. This is where all the cell bodies are. And then this right here is peripheral nervous system. What do we call a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites in the peripheral nervous system? A ganglion, right? A ganglion. So here's a ganglion, like dorsal root ganglia, for instance. Right. This is going to be a little bit different kind. And So this first cell is what we call a preganglionic cell. The second one is what we call a postganglionic cell. So I could ask you a question, what's a neurotransmitter that the preganglionic cell releases? You're going to say acetylcholine. What is the neurotransmitter released from the postganglionic cell for the sympathetic nervous system? Norepinephrine. Okay. Furthermore, I could ask you, what's the neurotransmitter released from the postganglionic cell of the parasympathetic nervous system? Where would you go? Back over here. Here's sympathetic. Here's parasympathetic. Are there two cells in this outflow pathway? Yep. Here's the preganglionic. Here's the post. And what does the postganglionic cell release? Acetylcholine. All right. So there are different neurotransmitters, depending on whether it's sympathetic or parasympathetic. But the preganglionic cell, whether it is sympathetic or parasympathetic, always uses acetylcholine. Between the pre- and postganglionic cells, always acetylcholine. All right, so for somatic outflow pathway to skeletal muscle, only one neuron. For an autonomic outflow pathway, it requires two. So there's got to be a ganglion someplace. And what are the effector organs for this autonomic nervous system? It shows you on this slide. What are the effector organs? I got smooth muscle here, blah, 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 like, for instance, reproductive tract, digestive tract, heart, cardiac muscle, and glands. That's right. Those are the three effector organs. What about the somatic nervous system? How many effector organs are there? By type. There's just one, just skeletal muscle. Okay. Now, norepinephrine sometimes can be excitatory, sometimes it's inhibitory. Acetylcholine can be excitatory, sometimes it is inhibitory. And the reason why that is because in order for the heart to respond to acetylcholine or norepinephrine, what does it have to have? In order for the heart to be able to recognize acetylcholine or norepinephrine floating around it, what does it have to have? It has to have a receptor. That's right. Just like in order for you to perceive light, you have to have a photoreceptor. You have to have photoreceptors in your retina. Okay? And receptors, even though there's one neurotransmitter, there are different receptor types. Some receptor types are excitatory. Other kinds of types are inhibitory. Right, so it depends. So one neurotransmitter can have different effects in different parts of the body because there can be different receptors in different parts of the body. All right, what else do I notice? What is the shortest preganglionic fiber? Is it sympathetic or parasympathetic? Sympathetic is shorter. Yeah, sympathetic is shorter. The preganglionic fiber for parasympathetic system is longer, which means that the postganglionic fiber for parasympathetic is shorter compared to the sympathetic one. One last point. One of the fibers, either the pre- or postganglionic fiber, is myelinated in both sympathetic and parasympathetic. Which one is myelinated? The preganglionic fiber is myelinated. The postganglionic fiber is always non-myelinated. That just happens to be that way. All right, so the sign-in sheet is going around. We're going to finish up with this diagram next time. So look it over. When are you going to look it over? This week. We're not at the weekend yet. We just got back from a weekend. Okay, so look it over today, Tuesday, or Wednesday morning, please.